Good evening, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. Hi, Filmatics. Today, we have one of my favorite writers and showrunner, Brendan Foley. Brendan Foley is an award-winning writer, and he is also a juror for the International Emmy Awards. And Brendan is also known for his film, Johnny Was, The Riddle, and new TV show called Cold Courage, and his best-selling book Under the Wire called Great Escape. Let's welcome Brendan to the show. Brendan, welcome to the show today.
Lovely to be here, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And I just want to say, Brendan, it's so amazing to come back because we had Wi-Fi issues the other day when we recorded. So he was so kind to come back. So I'm so happy you were
listening. My pleasure. Worst things happen on any production in history, so don't worry about it.
And Brendan, he is from Northern Ireland, but today you're recording live from where in the world today?
Santa Monica, just down the road from yourself. I work mostly out of London and the UK, but my wife's a comedy writer, Shelley Goldstein, in LA. So we come and go from one place to the other when needed.
Oh, and thank you so much to your lovely wife for letting us use the Zoom. So hi, Shelley Goldstein. And we're going to have to get her on the show as well. So, and today is International Women's Day. So yes, Shelley Goldstein.
Indeed, congratulations. And happy International Women's Day to the people who hold up half the sky.
Yeah, and even though that we are pre-recording in March, but you know, it's, we're also giving some love. And so I want to ask Brendan, so you're in Northern Ireland, but so we were talking last time about theaters in Northern Ireland. But did you have a favorite movie growing up as a kid that you loved?
Oh, thank you for asking it. I did have one or two. The only way to answer that, honestly, is that growing up in Belfast during the Troubles was an amazing place to grow up. Not necessarily the easiest, and a lot of people had it worse than me, but it was a very lively place. There was a lot of political violence, bombs and bomb scares. And as a backdrop, it was basically a sort of low-level war for the best part of 20 years. So because of that, we didn't get to run around as much as would have been normal for people of that generation. So when I was growing up in the 70s and early 80s, for instance, you would not often, at the worst of the Troubles, you would not venture out to legit theaters or movie theaters. There were big chunks of town that you would not want to be hanging around late at night. Aww. So sadly, that pushed a lot of us into watching a lot of TV. And so some of the movies that I originally watched were obviously from a previous generation. So I maybe had some of those formative experiences that in other places would have been 10 or 20 years earlier than on TV. But when we did venture out to movie theaters, a few things blew me away. I mean, one that I would really point to, and it may be a movie that some of your folk haven't seen yet, and if not, just beat a path to its door because it's an amazing show. Ordinary People. So it was around 1980-81 it came out. And American family drama. It was directed by Robert Redford. Actually, I think it was his directorial debut. And it was a screenplay by the wonderful Alvin Sargent, who I think just passed away last year, based on a novel. And it starred Donald Sutherland and Mary Tyler Moore. And another film debut, from what I remember, Timothy Hutton. So Mary Tyler Moore at that stage was sort of America's darling and sort of sitcom queen. And she plays the most monstrous, cold mother who is presiding over the disintegration of this sort of upper middle class family in Lake Forest, Illinois, following the accidental death of one of her two sons and the attempted suicide of the other, who's Timothy Hutton. And so for this this kid in Belfast staring at the silver screen, suddenly I was in the middle of this sort of upper middle class family meltdown and just outside of Chicago, at the same time, and it just blew me away because I was so connected to these characters in this world, even though my own experience was the absolute opposite, which was growing up in an area of much more volatility and turmoil and politics and violence just swimming around you. And yet I had a very, very stable home life. I just had I'm very blessed with really great parents who sadly aren't with us anymore.
Aww.
But it was like, it was the equivalent of growing up on Walton's Mountain, except with the world going to hell in a handbasket outside the door. But every time you closed the door, it was incredibly safe and loving, whereas poor old Timothy Hutton was there on the silver screen in Ordinary People, just with this desperate family sort of melting around him and trying to recover from his own guilt of being involved in an accident that his brother died in. So just a great movie. And it was the first time I realized, oh, someone makes these, someone writes them. It might seem incredibly obvious, but to a lot of people then and now, you just, unless you have a connection to the industry, you just sort of sat down and someone put a movie on your plate and it was just, it arrived there. You didn't think about where it came from. It was sort of delivered by Stork. So
Stork, yeah. I was a kid too. Like, how did they catch these people eating and sleep? Like, how did they do that?
Yeah,
like, you know?
What do you mean someone writes it? Amazing. So that's sort of, I've
it's
always
pretend.
Loved writing and, to be honest, it's the only thing I've ever been good at. And through my career since then, I've always had writing at the heart of it. I've done a lot of different things. I went from being a news journalist to a features journalist to international features, worked in 77 countries, and then hopped from that into writing books, and books into indie movies, which I wrote, produced, and directed mainly. Very, very tough road for anyone. And then in the last 5 years or so, I've segued into TV drama, particularly series drama, and particularly international co-productions around the world. And I'm loving every minute of it. It's a great time to have finally arrived in TV.
Oh, and that's so beautiful. I'm like cheering for you because you're this kid that most kids seem to, you think that most kids get to watch like E.T., The Goonies, and Escape to Witch Mountain, and Star Wars, and all these fun kids movies, and like all the animation ones. And then you are in literally, is it turmoil and violence and all this stuff outside your door. But I'm just so happy that you had loving parents that really brought you into a beautiful place.
Yeah, it makes a big difference too. If you're a storyteller, you know, sometimes great storytellers come from really appalling backgrounds and they storytell their way out of them. But at other times, if you have, you know, a mixture of sort of a lively world outside but the security inside, to essentially put everything in order in your own head and be an observer. A lot of good writers tend to spend, you know, a little more time listening than talking. And for me, a lot of the really great movies, there was that great period from sort of 66 to 76 that was sort of movie heaven for storytellers, and your sort of Butch Cassidy's and everything from The Great Escape, Butch Cassidy, right the way up to, there's a great turning point for a later and equally great set of movies, but around 76, 77, you've got the start of Star Wars, you have Jaws. So they're spectacle driven. They are, you know, they're very grand and they do blow you away on a big screen. But essentially their plots are often, I'd say, less complex or less human, or at least plot and story is not the main reason people are there. A lot of people go for spectacle, and that carries right the way through to lots of the really excellent sort of movies inspired by comic books and so on. But for me, there was just that great first grounding in characters like Cool Hand Luke, just these amazing larger than life stories about anti-heroes. And if you look at where they ended up, that's now what made TV fantastic. So Tony Sopranos of this world, anti-hero, sort of larger-than-life characters, or Breaking Bad, Walter White, or characters in Deadwood. So that's where that sort of really fantastic high-end storytelling ended up. And I'm just blessed that there's somewhere for it to go now.
And
because just sure as eggs is eggs, they would, you know, those movies would not be being made now for the big screen, because they would never have the box office of, you know, one of the big TV, you know, the big feature of tentpole franchises might cost $250 million to make and another $250 million to advertise. Meanwhile, the budget of an average indie movie in Europe is about $1 million. So you could have 250 indies for the same price as sort of half the price of Spider-Man 17, which isn't at all to knock, you know, that sort of big franchise, but they're just different animals. And for a lot of people trying to find their way into the industry, I think that if I was starting again, I'd sort of look partly to TV, despite having been inspired by the silver screen.
Yeah, and thank goodness that you're writing, because I think that people need the meat and potatoes, and I call stories with a character-driven and drama-driven that aren't the big special effects and stuff, but it's really about the story. And I think people are starving for the meat and potatoes type of...
Yeah, I think so too. And you can tell that from the success of things on like Netflix, for instance. I mean, The Queen's Gambit, I don't know if you saw that, but
yes.
if you tried to, in LA, if you tried to knock on a door and pitch, I've got this great idea, it's about people playing chess and it's set in the 1960s. You know, you would have felt the door hitting you on the way out.
And she's a female, and she...
Yeah, just like a ridiculous...
And you know...
It did take years to make, and it's... That's fine. I don't have any involvement in it, but as far as I know, it started life as a feature that couldn't get made. And, you know, eventually someone stretched it out into a miniseries and people just loved it. You can tell you're in an interesting business where the sales of chess sets rocketed after it was on. And, you know, it may have something to do with the world of COVID too, but nonetheless, you can have a massive impact now on storytelling, on TV, on the streamers in particular. So hats off to them.
Yeah, and so you're a boy in Northern Ireland, and did you ever get to, I'm wondering, like, you know, you mentioned some, you were able to eventually get to some films and TV shows, but I was wondering, do you have a favorite Criterion film that might have inspired your career path?
A Criterion one, so like most people from Belfast, and I love my hometown, but at the time in the early 80s, there were, you know, economic opportunities were few, and you know, the troubles were raging. So virtually everyone who I went to school with departed as fast as their little legs would carry them. There's an old saying that Ireland's biggest export is people. There's a certain amount of truth to that. I love going back now. I've actually brought some movies back there that I'm very proud of. But at the very start of that, when I ended up in England for the first time, so, you know, young guy trying to make his way as a young journalist, and I saw a Criterion movie called The Long Good Friday. So sort of early 80s, beautiful noir gangster film. It starred Bob Hoskins in, I think, probably his greatest role, and Helen Mirren. It sort of weaves through events in the late 1970s, when at that time it was a bit probably like Reaganomics happening in America. Margaret Thatcher had come to power, and there was just a complete devastation of the industry and the working class that had been the sort of backbone of Britain up to that point. And so people were looking around, wondering where their future lay. And there was the start of the sort of 1980s, like the City of London and the bankers and the Spivs and the sort of bonfire of the vanities world in New York. And against a backdrop to that, there was sort of police corruption. There was IRA bombs in London.
This turmoil follows you. It follows you to London, Brandon.
So that was basically someone who said, I'm going to do a gangster film where some London East End villains who think they're hard and who are, you know, they're criminals and murderers or whatever, but basically in comparison to what followed them, they were surprisingly gentle and didn't go to war at the drop of a hat. So suddenly they are faced with having peed off some IRA fundraisers, and suddenly things start blowing up around them. So it was, I suppose for me, it had one foot in each camp. And Bob Hoskins is just amazing in it as this London. He's like a sort of one of the Cray twins, that type of East End villain gangster. And I won't spoil the plot, but at one point his enemies, and he can't even work out who they are, and that's why it's such a wonderful movie. He's trying to work out who's trying to blow him and his dear old mum up. And at one point he finds one of his colleagues nailed to a floor in East London, and he's outraged and he says, "You don't go around crucifying people, not on Good Friday," which is where the name comes from. So it's got a lot of black humor in it, but it's just a powerful little movie. I watched it again recently and I just think it's as good as ever. It's become a period piece, but for me it was just a great introduction to a new, different world.
And what a line. You don't go around crucifying people on Friday. And Bob Hoskins.
Not Good Friday.
Yeah. So what sometimes the writing and the writing is so magical. And like to pull that line off and say it just amazingly, like what a great actor, what a great writer. And
Yeah. It's a great combination. I mean, as a writer, there is nothing better than if you write a good line and someone like, I did a movie with Derek Jacobi. So Derek Jacobi is probably the greatest living stage actor. He's been in a lot of big movies as well, but he's most famous for his theatrical work. And seeing him taking a line and bringing it to life, or seeing him listening to another character while eating a piece of toast, and he's more talented eating a piece of toast than most actors I've seen, sort of given the best soliloquy in the world. He's just, a beautiful, gentle, real lovely person to work with. But he can just, knock you dead with an okay line. And if you give him something great, he'll just knock it out of the park.
Stage acting and great actors are great. And we were speaking of you. We were talking about our favorite director. Can you share one of your favorite directors?
Briefly, it was someone who gave me a really great piece of advice, Sidney Pollack. And Sidney Pollack, one of my favorite movies. I've always loved good westerns. And Jeremiah Johnson is one for the ages, again from the early 70s. Jeremiah Johnson, directed by Sidney Pollack. Actually, we were talking about Robert Redford as a director earlier, but this movie, Jeremiah Johnson, starred Robert Redford, and it's effectively about a mountain man trying to build a new life for himself and ending up in a feud with some of the locals. But years after, so a great movie just on its own to take a look at. But I didn't know him well, but I had a friend who was a very good friend of Sidney Pollack's, and he kindly, when I was making my first feature, introduced me. And I only got to talk to Sidney Pollack once, but I was sort of typical eager beaver trying to get some advice, and he gave me the best advice that I only really understand now because it sounds so simple. But he just said, make sure everyone's making the same movie. And that sounds so simple, but that's really all it's about. And that can go for your heads of department, it can go for going from a script to going to the actors, that the actors are all making the same movie, that the crew are all making the same movie. And it does start with a great script, but you then, in the world of features, you then need someone with an amazing effort of will to pull it together, and that's a director like Sydney Pollack.
Oh wow, Sydney Pollack, a fabulous director. And which leads me to ask you, one of your favorite film shots, can you share with me?
I'm going to rocket from ancient history to much more recent history now, and if I can sort of segue into TV land, I think some of the most wonderful writing recently has been on Better Call Saul. So, again, I won't spoil it if people haven't seen it, but it's just every season gets better and better. The showrunner is a guy called Peter Gould, who I'm not fit to remove his pen cap for him. He's just primo writer. And there's a little scene in that where they have a lawyer hustler character, Saul Goodman, and he's sort of like a park bench lawyer hustler, and everything is going incredibly well for him at one point. He's walking down the street with a large ice cream and is very pleased with himself. And then some of the gangsters who he often represents drive up beside him and tell him to get in the back of the car. So he doesn't know whether he's about to be shot and dumped in the desert or whether he's being asked to do something. And the gangster, who obviously has a sort of pimp mobile, isn't keen on this ice cream coming anywhere near his lovely car. So he just tells Saul Goodman to drop the ice cream. The ice cream falls, ice cream first, with a sort of the cone pointing up like a wizard's hat. And then Saul is driven off to his fate. And then there's a little scene of a macro photography where a tiny little ant is walking across the sidewalk and suddenly comes to the bottom of this ice cream, which to him looks like the Matterhorn in the Alps. And in the background, you start to hear this amazing, slightly demented sort of 1950s yodeling tune. And then there's another ant and another ant and another ant until by the end of this scene, they're climbing and swarming. And it's quite disturbing because you have a sort of an ice cream covered in ants on the sidewalk. But it's also extremely funny with the yodeling in the background. And for one of the nicest things, if you have some kind of history in movies, is that you can see the same thing happening. So probably the greatest Western ever made, in my opinion, was Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch. And it starts with a similar scene as kids in the street playing, but it's a lot crueler and more visceral, but it's a scorpion trying to fight off ants, and it is this big prehistoric looking creature, a scorpion, which looks giant in the scheme of things in the camera, and these tiny things swarming around it, and that becomes a metaphor for the Wild Bunch, who are a bunch of Western desperados who have outlived their time and are being swarmed over by the law and by progress. So similarly in each, I don't know if Peter Gould was in any way aware of that, and it didn't matter because what he did was so original with it. But in each case, it was about sort of idea that, you know, man plans and God laughs, and a little ant is feeling like it's all of its Christmases have come at once, and actually it's just an ant on the sidewalk and it may be trodden on at any moment. So that to me is great sort of micro storytelling, when a lesser writer would just have had the ice cream is dumped on the sidewalk and he gets in the car.
Ooh, so it's like I was thinking it's foreshadowing as the ants eat the ice cream. It's going to be eaten up by the gangsters.
So yes, it's just, and it doesn't need to, you don't need to sort of whack them over the head with a metaphor. It's just there if people want to see it. And otherwise, it's just an incredibly entertaining shot of, look what's happened is ice cream. So, good scenes tend to work on a multiplicity of levels for different people and different audiences.
Yeah, and speaking of, so you had this, can you tell us a little bit about your film, Johnny Was? That was filmed in your hometown, Northern Ireland.
Yeah, that was my first feature as a writer and producer, and I also directed post and soundpost on it. It has one of its strong points is a most amazing reggae soundtrack. If anyone likes reggae, check it out. Just amazing soundtrack there. And it had a really interesting cast at the time. So this gets back to if people are trying to break into writing, just try to write something that jumps off the page. That's not just another Me Too. It has to be something that when it gets into an actor's hands, he or she says, I haven't done this before, and I think I could really bring this to life. So I was fortunate enough to get Vinnie Jones, who was riding high after Lock, Stock, Two Smoking Barrels, and he wanted to do something that showed off his acting chops more than just being the sort of villain number one. And he really did. He rocked it, and he just brought his A game to it. And then the rest of the cast was just crazy and larger than life. So we had Roger Daltrey from The Who, who is also a very handy actor, apart from being a primo rock star. And we had Lennox Lewis, the boxer, playing a Rasta pirate DJ. It's set in London, and it's basically Irish and West Indian and Black Londoners and Black Irish and White Irish all bumping into each other in the very rowdy area of Brixton in South London. So a critic once described it as "Guess Who's Coming to Dinner with Firearms," which I was very pleased with.
Guess Who's Coming to Dinner with Firearms. So I want to talk to you. You got to bring this, you got to write, direct, and produce a film back in your homeland of Northern Ireland.
Yeah, it was fun to bring it home because, at that stage, there wasn't very much heading for, Belfast was not twinned with Hollywood, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. And just to see the amount of work that it brought locally and the crew and just how passionate the locals were and how excited they were about seeing some of their heroes wandering down the streets between shots, particularly actually Lennox Lewis had like sort of as a world champion boxer, was just treated as, people practically bowed down in the street when they saw him. They were so excited. So that was really, really great fun, bringing that home. And it wasn't easy. Like all indie movies, we were holding it together with A Wing and a Prayer and sort of Sellotape and Hope. But we got it made, and it won some awards, so we did okay with it. And since then, the people, I would like to say thank you to one particular bunch who made a big difference to me. Northern Ireland Screen are the sort of local, the body that promotes and encourages investment in film. And right from day one, they just completely had my back while I was trying to do this nigh impossible thing of getting a fairly big indie movie going. And since then, we shot in what was then a disused shipyard where the Titanic had been built, for instance, and it didn't augur very well for movies. But it was a great giant disused shipyard, and we shot in the paint hall there, one of the first movies to do so. Since then, that has become one of several massive studios in Belfast, where more than 80% of Game of Thrones was shot. So they really made the most of what started with a few little indie movies and built to an amazing industry. And they now have such talented crew there. So hats off to the people who helped to build that at Northern Ireland Screen.
So thank you, Northern Ireland Screen. So Film Addicts and everyone, please join us back for part two with Brandon Foley, award-winning writer and showrunner. And so join us back for part two, because I'm going to ask him how Roger Daltrey of The Who and Leonard Lennox, the world boxer, was in his first film. So stay tuned with us for part two.